Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week's worth of programs. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll be concentrating primarily on the changes that have come about in the court recently as we transition from the Rehnquist Court to the Roberts Court. And our guest for the program is Jan Crawford Greenberg. She's correspondent for ABC News, and she covers law and politics for all of their major shows, including World News Tonight, Nightline, Good Morning America. She previously served as Supreme Court analyst for The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and Face the Nation on CBS, and was chief legal affairs writer for the Chicago Tribune. She covered the U.S. Supreme Court for 12 years and has had interviews with 9 of its justices, and she has taken all of this experience and put it into a recently published book, which we will talk about here this morning. The title of her book is Supreme Conflict. The subtitle is The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court. The Penguin Press is the publisher, and it concentrates particularly on the effort going back to, roughly speaking, the presidency of Richard Nixon, the effort of Republican to push the Supreme Court to the right, something that she argued was really only finally accomplished by the current President Bush. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk here this morning with our guest. And you can call in at one of two numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anyone here is welcome to call in and join the conversation. Ms. Greenberg, hello.
Hi, how are you, David?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
Very well, thanks. Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. There are a lot of things that I would like to try to talk about, both the present and a little bit about the past, and certainly why it is that this change in the court matters. I suppose just as a matter of history, it's worth pointing out that with the death of Mr. Rehnquist and the retirement of Justice O'Connor, one reason this is a big change is that the same group of people was together, the same group of justices was together for a long time. And in fact, in the history of the court, I think they have a record for this group of people being together for the longest period of time.
That's right. I mean, they sat together, served together for 11 long years. And that's the longest in history a court of 9 justices has served without a change in membership. And so, of course, you know, every year, starting really back in 2001, you know, the journalists would write about how this year, surely we were going to have a retirement, you know, a historic opportunity to change the direction of the court. And then, you know, the year would come and go. And so when William Rehnquist announced that he was very ill with thyroid cancer, we all, of course, knew at that moment that the court was going to get a vacancy. The White House, you know, started interviewing replacements, quite secretly, of course, all of us expecting that William Rehnquist would retire. O'Connor's decision to step down first was just a bombshell. And that gave the president this dramatic opportunity to change the direction of the court because, as you know, the court was so closely divided for all those years on all the big social issues like abortion and religion and affirmative action. And on all those cases, it was Sandra Day O'Connor who was casting the deciding vote, and generally with the liberals. So her retirement gave President Bush an historic opportunity.
This is the kind of thing, this sort of analysis and second-guessing is the thing that legal scholars and reporters and everyone really does when they're looking at the justices, trying to figure out how any justice is going to rule on a particular case. And then when you come to a big change like this, what this means for the character of the court. Mm-hmm. And I think that the general assumption is that we now have a more conservative court than we had. Now, having said that, though, I imagine some people would say, well, you replaced one conservative with a conservative. Rehnquist with Roberts. Sandra Day O'Connor was considered to be a conservative, although she did have this important role as being the court's swing voter where she could go either way. And now another justice, and Mr. Kennedy, I think, really has taken over that role. So we replaced two conservatives with two conservatives. How much indeed has the court changed?
Well, actually, it's changed quite a lot. And absolutely, when we think about the Chief Justice retiring, or a lot of people thought he would die before the end of the term, and Bush getting that replacement, you know, you're right. I mean, he's replacing a conservative with a conservative, although I think you can argue that John Roberts is, in fact, more conservative than William Rehnquist and will be more effective than William Rehnquist. So that wasn't this great moment to change the direction of the court. And, you know, that's something that Republican presidents have tried to do for decades. I mean, going back to Richard Nixon, and we had Ronald Reagan, and, you know, they'd failed. I mean, you have to have a nominee who's more conservative, and in the case of Republicans, and they're going to be replacing someone who's liberal. And O'Connor was not liberal, but she certainly is not a solid conservative. So when she announces her retirement, you know, that was the ball game for many conservatives, because she had greatly constrained conservative efforts to, you know, impose restrictions on abortion, to outlaw affirmative action, to, you know, allow prayer in schools. I mean, on all these big social issue cases that conservatives really care about and that liberals do too, O'Connor had been casting that key vote with the liberal side. So in case after case after case, O'Connor was frustrating conservatives, encouraging liberals, and now George Bush had this moment to change the court, and in her place, he got Samuel Alito, who is unquestionably more conservative than Sandra Day O'Connor, you know, who sees abortion issues very differently. He sees race cases very differently, presidential power cases very differently, religion cases very differently. I mean, and on all these issues now, because the court was divided 5-4 with O'Connor, you know, being that swing vote, the court is now poised to change.
Yeah. Traditionally, the members of the court do not talk a lot about themselves, and certainly they don't talk about what goes on behind closed doors at the court. That's why when a book like yours comes along, or anything else that opens the door even a crack, then we are all very interested, because this is a very closed world. One of the things that you talk about here that is indeed interesting, and you touched on it, was the whole business of the resignations of the two, of the Chief Justice and of Sandra Day O'Connor, because as you said, there certainly were people who knew back in, I think even in the fall of 2004, that Mr. Rehnquist was very, very ill, and that he was not expected to live terribly much longer. And for that reason, a lot of people expected his would be the first resignation to be announced in all these many years. And,
oh, yes.
And as you say, everybody was shocked when, in fact, it wasn't Rehnquist who announced that he was stepping down. It was Sandra Day O'Connor who announced that she was stepping down. How did that whole business come about?
Oh, it's just fascinating, and it's really kind of a sad story. I mean, you know, this was a man who had led the court for almost 20 years, and he was dying before our eyes. So, of course, everyone, the White House that was doing all these secret interviews to replace him, the justices themselves, I mean, everyone thought that William Rehnquist was going to step down if he lived that long. I mean, there was a real question about whether he would even make it until the end of June, the end of the court's term in 2005. His old friend from the West, Sandra Day O'Connor, you know, remember they'd gone to Stanford Law School together. They'd known each other more than 50 years. She assumed he would be stepping down. Her husband was ill himself with Alzheimer's, and she knew that she herself would have to be leaving the court at some point. So toward the end of the term, she went to talk to her old friend. She just wanted to, you know, say, look, you know, I know you're going to be leaving this place, and I'm going to have to follow you at some point because John, her husband, was ill. And Rehnquist shocked her. He said, you know, I don't want to talk right now. Let's just talk later. You know, he hadn't made up his mind. And so a month or two later, again, right as the term was getting to the end, she went back to see her old friend, again, expecting that he would say, you know, I'm pleased I was able to survive the rest of the term and I will be retiring. And instead he said, I'm going to stay another year. I think I can make it another year, and we don't need, and this was the dramatic message that he had for her, we don't need two vacancies. And the implication of that was, if O'Connor was going to be leaving the court to care for her sick husband, she should step down now, at that moment, or be prepared to wait another 2 years, because he was going to try to stay another year. And O'Connor felt that she couldn't do that, that she couldn't stay for two more years. And so she quite reluctantly, and I think with some degree of sadness, concluded that since he was insistent on staying another year and insistent that they didn't need two vacancies, that she would retire. And of course, that announcement, that Friday at the very beginning of July in 2005, you know, shocked Washington and set off a chain of events that gave George Bush a chance to change the direction of the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court justices are appointed for life, and the idea is that that way they should be isolated from any kind of political pressure on their decision making. However, it also means that it is up to each individual justice, unless they're completely incapacitated. It's up to each individual justice to decide whether he or she is fit enough to carry out their responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Is, given this recent experience, particularly the recent experience with Mr. Rehnquist, has anybody even suggested the idea that maybe having it that way is not the best way?
No, I haven't heard talk of that, although certainly, and as you suggest, I mean, historically there have been other examples where justices serve too long, and in fact serve beyond they should, you know, their mental capacities. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no suggestion that Rehnquist himself was, you know, suffering mentally. I mean, his mind was still sharp, his body was in great physical decline, and he, like I said, was just dying before all of our eyes. I mean, he was very thin and stooped, and, you know, he had had a tracheotomy. He had a very difficult time even speaking. That was a difficult year for the court. The justices themselves, you know, during the conferences, those private conferences where they all sit around the table and vote on cases, no one else is in the room, you know, some of them felt quite constrained because Rehnquist was so sick that they weren't as forceful in making their points. And others would write more opinions because Rehnquist was doing less work that year. It was a very difficult time for the court. Many people believe, including the justices themselves, believe that Rehnquist should have sat down at the end of that term. As it turned out, he lived only 2 months during the summer. But, you know, he was willing to try to stick it out and raise the risk there, of course, that he would have died in the middle of the term, leaving the court without a leader. But I haven't seen anyone suggesting that we need to change things. In the past, what's happened, justices have actually gone and talked to, if there were a justice who seemed to be declining mentally, you know, the justices, the colleagues would go and say, you know, we think it's time for you to step down. That didn't happen in this case with William Rehnquist. He decided he was going to stick it out another year, and, you know, fate didn't allow him to do that.
Yeah. Well, I would say it certainly wasn't meaning to suggest that somehow he was impaired.
Oh, mentally,
right. It did have an impact on the way the court operated.
Absolutely.
Could you make the judgment and say that in fact that it had a negative impact on the way the court operated?
I think it's hard to say. You know, the work of the court got done, the business of the court continued, the opinions got written, the cases were decided on time. And when he was off the bench, you know, he missed almost four months of arguments, because he was too sick to go to court. I mean, that's, you know, when the justices are only on the bench 9-10 months out of the year, that's a pretty good amount. And during that time, John Paul Stevens, the court's most senior associate justice, took over. He ran the arguments, and he would run some of those private conferences when Rehnquist was too ill to go. And the funny thing about the striking thing about Rehnquist is he was this man. He always would complain about justices who would stay on too long, past their prime, and he would say to his clerks, I don't understand why, you know, they're just sticking around. They should retire. And he always insisted that he would never stay, you know, even longer than 70, 75. Of course, he was 80. And so even his own clerks and associates and close friends, they couldn't understand why he was doing this. And to this day, it just baffles them, like, why he insisted on staying on that court. And some have suggested that's just very much in character with Rehnquist, that, you know, every day was a new day, I'm well enough, I'll do my job, I'll go to court, I can still work, I can still do my job. But others have said, and I think quite persuasively, that that's really at odds with someone who always thought and had a great respect for the institution. You know, if you think about Justice O'Connor, you know, she saw that Rehnquist wanted to stay on. She agreed that the court didn't need two vacancies. She wasn't quite ready to retire, but she put the interests of the institution above her own interests.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jan Crawford Greenberg. She's a correspondent for ABC News, covers law and politics for ABC. She has covered the United States Supreme Court for 12 years, has had interviews with 9 of the justices, and she has a new book out that is about the struggle for control of the court. It's titled Supreme Conflict, and it's published by Penguin Press. And we have a couple of callers here, and so we will go to them, bring them into the conversation, starting with someone in a nearby community of Belgium. And that's line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Continuing on with Mr. Rehnquist, excuse me, if what I understand is true, he had a problem with drugs during these illnesses, and he continued on to make decisions in drug cases that really were pretty much what he was doing. He was abusing drugs. Now, how can those decisions he made be considered valid?
Well, the Chief Justice had a pretty well-documented problem with drugs in the mid-1980s when he was suffering from terrible back pain and became addicted to prescription drugs, and in fact was treated for that. Sure, you're right. I mean, that's been written about recently. My colleague Tony Morrow did a series of articles about it, you know, at that time and how that did or didn't affect the decisions that he might have been making. So at that time, all those stories were being written. There was no suggestion, though, this most recent time when he was suffering from cancer that he was taking any kind of drugs or affecting his mental capacity. So, and you know, back 20 years ago when he was taking those prescription drugs, I wasn't covering the court then. But people I've spoken with who were, and people who were following the court very closely at that time and who were involved in those decisions, you know, they insist that, you know, he got the help and treatment he needed, and that it didn't affect his decision making capacity. But I mean, those are, you know, opinions of people who were there at the time, and certainly not my own. I didn't have any independent knowledge of that at the time.
Well, that's the time frame that I was referring to
uh-huh.
at that point. And it just, well,
but it does raise the question
yeah,
that David was talking about, you know, when justices do become incapacitated, you know, what can we do, or what can the court do as an institution? And what they've done historically is the other justices, they've just kind of relied on, you know, it's kind of just this, the power of the group. You know, they go and talk to them and say, you need help. I mean, that happened in the case of William O. Douglas, who was serving on, many people in the court believe, past the time that he should have retired. So that's how they've continued to operate. Now, of course, if these kind of incidents were to come up with any frequency, I would suspect that you would see great, great calls for change in that system.
Thank you very much.
No, thanks. And he was, we should point out, I guess, that at this time, he was not then the Chief Justice.
Right. Right. He would have been, he was still the associate. Hmm. And then President Reagan nominated him to be Chief Justice in 1986.
Let's go on. We have some other callers here. A couple here in Champaign. First line number 1. Hello.
Yes, I agree with you that since Richard Nixon, there has been an overweening desire by Republican presidents to take the Supreme Court to the right, the conservative right. But my question to you is, when President Bush had a chance to replace Justice O'Connor, how did Harriet Myers figure into
that? Oh, isn't that a great, I mean, that's just almost hard to believe that even happened, isn't it? You know, and here the whole story of Myers, again, is one that I was able to finally get my sources to tell me what really happened, what the president was really thinking, and how that came about, because obviously it looked like just a spectacular blunder, and in fact, I think that it was. But there were so many things going on at that time, but two main things drove President Bush's thinking on Harriet Myers. Number one, you know, after Rehnquist died, he moved John Roberts over, and then he had to find another nominee for O'Connor. And he said to Andy Card, his chief of staff, that he wanted a woman or a minority to replace her. And so Card instructed Myers and her staff to go find a woman or a minority. No white guys is what he told them. And so as they were trying to find this qualified woman or minority candidate, they kept coming up short. And Bush got enamored with the idea of nominating his friend, loyal friend, Harriet Myers, because, and this is number two, he was seared, and that's the way his advisors have put it to me, he was seared by his father's decision to nominate David Souter to the Supreme Court. Now, David Souter, very thoughtful justice, but a very liberal justice that many conservatives believe to be one of the biggest presidential mistakes when George Bush put him on the Supreme Court. The dad, George H.W. Bush's advisors, were telling him David Souter was a conservative. You know, he was a solid conservative. He would move the court to the right because, remember, he was replacing that liberal icon, William Brennan. So H.W. Bush had this huge opportunity to change the direction of the court in that nomination. So the son, George W. Bush, was determined not to repeat that mistake, and he knew Harriet Myers was a conservative. He knew her. It wasn't like Souter. His dad didn't know Souter. He knew Harriet Myers, and he thought she would not change, that she would get on that Supreme Court, and she would be a solid conservative vote, and that's what he had promised to do, and he was going to deliver. So, you know, that set the ball in motion, but then there are an enormous number, which I detail, of just missteps and managerial mistakes, vetting failures that actually led her to be nominated. You know, her own deputy, Bill Kelly, a very highly regarded legal scholar from Notre Dame, was put in the awkward place of being asked to actually vet his boss, which, again, was a terrible mistake. You know, and then President Bush didn't listen to some of the advice he got. I mean, he was advised by Kelly and others that Sam Alito was the best nominee, and Bush was insistent on nominating Harriet Myers. And one of the most incredible stories, I think, during that time was that the one administration official, the most high-ranking person in the administration, who actually went to the president, urged him not to nominate Harriet Myers, said she wasn't right for the Supreme Court, that conservatives would revolt, that he could not nominate her. One person did that, and it was the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. Now, that whole story, you know, Gonzalez had been a presumptive nominee himself, and so, you know, conservatives thought he wasn't conservative enough to be on the Supreme Court. And, you know, you just got the irony of it that, you know, the one person at the end who tried to block Harriet Myers was none other than Alberto Gonzalez. It's pretty rich, really. But of course, you know, when Gonzalez went to the White House, he laid out his concerns to President Bush, told him why he believed it was a mistake to nominate Harriet Myers. And of course, you know, President Bush didn't listen. He had made up his mind, and 3 days later, he announced that he was nominating his loyal advisor to the Supreme Court.
And then there was a firestorm among
immediately, immediately. And then, you know, that's another great irony. I mean, the conservatives here was George Bush thinking that he was nominating someone who was going to be a solid conservative, who was not David Souter, who would not change. You know, he was not going to repeat his dad's mistake. And then, of course, the conservatives immediately saw that Harriet Myers was going to be exactly like David Souter. She didn't have a background in constitutional law. She wasn't this big legal heavyweight. You know, so the minute that George W. Bush went back to Texas, Harriet Myers was going to drift over to the left like all the justices that they thought had done in the past. You know, she wasn't going to be able to stand up to those intellectual heavyweights like Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, you know, next thing you know, she would be voting liberal just like O'Connor did and Kennedy and Souter. And so, you know, they reacted with, you know, with just outrage. And it was a really weird time to be in Washington because, you know, here was this pivotal seat that would change the direction of the Supreme Court that we thought was going to be this big battle. You know, the left was ready for it. The right was ready for it. And so Bush nominates Harriet Myers. And what happens? The right goes crazy and the left, no one really knows what to do. So.
But thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. It's interesting, as you point out, that apparently one of the things that President Bush was thinking about was he wanted to have the nominee to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm just struck by the fact that not that long ago, in the past couple of weeks or so, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave a speech saying, and basically she said she was not really happy being the only woman on the court. Are there a lot of people around Washington that actually think it really would be important for there to be some more gender balance on the court?
Yes, absolutely. And Justice O'Connor told me herself, when I was fortunate enough to interview her at some length for the book, how disappointed she was. She said, "I was so sad that didn't happen, that a woman didn't replace her." And she's spoken recently again publicly about how disappointed she was. Justice Ginsburg has said, you know, she finds it very lonely up there. It's hard to believe that a court with nine people and only one would be a woman. And So I think what we can take from that, and of course, remember, O'Connor and Ginsburg were also, and Laura Bush were also urging George W. Bush to nominate a woman at the time to replace O'Connor. Which then led him to say no white guys. But I think what we can take from this is that it's not much of a stretch for me to predict that the next nominee, whether it's by a Republican or by a Democrat, and whether it's in the next 2 years or whether it's after the election, the next nominee to the Supreme Court will be a woman.
Well, we have another caller here, and let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Jan Crawford Greenberg. She's correspondent for ABC News, and she covers law and politics for all of their big shows, World News Tonight, Nightline, Good Morning America, This Week with George Stephanopoulos. She also previously served as Supreme Court analyst for The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and Face the Nation on CBS, and was also chief legal affairs writer for the Chicago Tribune. She's covered the court for 12 years. Her new book is Supreme Conflict, the Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court, and it's published by the Penguin Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana to call if you'd like to call in, ask a question, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have another caller, and this is also someone in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes, I very much enjoyed your reports on the NewsHour, so it's nice to get a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. And I have to say, as much as I'm enjoying ABC, I really miss the NewsHour. It was just such a great program, and it is. Jim is just amazing. And the funny thing is, all the justices watch it. So, I would say something, and, you know, they would, whenever I would see them later, they would say, you know, what you said. So, you know, it's a show that even the justices watch.
Interesting. I just have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Obviously, you're making an argument in your book, which unfortunately I haven't read yet, but the court has moved significantly to the right. But one thing I just was curious about, it's obvious that the court is, at least in more general terms, significantly to the right of the general populace, let's say on social issues, for example. And I'm just wondering, to project ahead, obviously in your book you probably don't really project ahead much, but I'm just wondering if you could, in general terms, first of all, consider the effects of the next 10, 20, perhaps 30 years of this market shift of the court, and also, secondarily, what really, given that these are lifetime terms and these are young individuals, Alito and Roberts, for example, what can the citizenry do about this? If we're upset, for example, about the extent of the degree of changes that could foreseeably occur in their decisions at the court's level, what really can be done?
Well, those are all really interesting points that you make, and there are a couple different things we can think about. I mean, the court generally, even over the years, even when people were saying impeach Earl Warren, you know, the court generally has not gotten too far ahead of public opinion, whether on the left or on the right. And there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. And in fact, Rehnquist gave a series of speeches in the 1980s when he talked about the kind of the influence of public opinion on the Supreme Court and how it's almost impossible to prevent it. You know, that it's kind of just like the tides are being affected. Of course, the court's going to be affected by public opinion, and it has. And so that's kind of constrained it from getting too far ahead or on either side, left or right. Mm-hmm. And I think that even the court recently, I mean, you know, you can argue about whether it's to the right of the general populace or to not. I mean, that would obviously depend very much on your point of view. I mean, conservatives see a court that, you know, has not allowed any restrictions really on abortion. You know, they have struck down laws on homosexual sex, which, remember that opinion that was very controversial from a conservative perspective. You know, religion, on and on. Liberals could say, but, you know, this is a court that put George Bush in the White House. This is a very conservative court. So, you know, some of the decisions cut differently depending on what your point of view is to begin with. But going forward, when we think about this court, and again, I mean, I think that it's not, you know, it doesn't have five solid conservatives. It's not going to veer, you know, sharply and irrevocably to the right, because there's still one guy, Anthony Kennedy, who sometimes sides with liberals. But Kennedy is much more conservative than O'Connor. So this is a court that's going to turn to the right, and in some cases, I think, pretty dramatically, like abortion and affirmative action and all those cases that people get very, very engaged in and care very deeply about. And I think we will see some controversial decisions. So what can you do as a citizen? Well, you know, who votes on the Supreme Court? I mean, who gets to decide? Well, it's the president. You know, so I think the Supreme Court could have an impact in the election in 08, because the next president is going to get, I believe, at least one nomination. John Paul Stevens is 87 years old. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, while she seems very healthy now, I mean, people have speculated for years that she might be wanting to step down. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is where I think we'll see, you know, if the court does start taking opinions and making decisions that people dramatically disagree with, you're going to see the court affecting being an issue in the election, whether it's for president or for the Senate. But short of that, you know, there's, you know, you can't really impeach justices for opinions, as you know, that
right.
You know, you don't like. But and I'm sure people would like to do that.
Right. I mean, obviously there are those on the right, for example, who've become very activist vis-a-vis the court and scared the justice.
Yeah.
So
and, you know, we've seen some of those books, you know, about how the court's going to, you know, ruin from the conservative side, that the court is, you know, going to, you know, is ruining America. And then, you know, you see books written, particularly after Bush versus Gore, you know, really criticizing the court for being too conservative. So, you know, this court, I think the Rehnquist court is certainly you couldn't say it was a liberal court by any means, but it also disappointed conservatives. And, you know, now with Roberts in the center seat and with Alito taking Justice O'Connor's place, there's no question that we're going to see it becoming more conservative. Now, how much more conservative, I think we're going to have to wait and see. And if it gets dramatically more conservative, I think I agree with you. I mean, I think that then, you know, you'll see people really starting to react. And at that moment, you know, who knows? I mean, then it could be an issue in the presidential election, too.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
I think that the idea is of the court is that it should be, as I said, it should be, I don't know if isolated is the right word, but it should be somewhat apart from political pressure and also from public opinion. Having said that, though, the justices they're not immune to public opinion. And I think if you look at the history of the court, you can indeed find cases where justices did seem to be influenced in their decision by their perception of what the rest of the country thought about some particular issue. How, to the extent that you can talk about that, and having had some contact with some justices, have you talked about that? How do they think about public opinion?
Well, some do and some don't. And obviously conservatives would complain that, you know, the Supreme Court is clearly affected by public opinion, but that public opinion goes in one direction. I mean, this is a conservative argument, and that's, you know, toward the liberal editorial pages of the New York Times, you know, that they see that influence on the justices, and that's why the justices tend to drift to the left, and that's what conservatives believe. And some of the justices do care and have written, and I've found memos, and I've talked to them about this, you know, how their opinions are perceived. Justice Kennedy, for example, is much more sensitive to criticism, and in the documents and memos that I was able to come across in my research, I found a couple where he was openly worrying about what the public would think or how they would react. Justice Breyer is more sensitive. I mean, and again, from Breyer's perspective, it would be he's wanting the opinions to be reported accurately. So, you know, he will read the newspaper articles to make sure that, you know, what the court's saying is actually being accurately reported. Other justices believe very strongly that their job, as kind of your question was suggesting, is independent completely of politics or public opinion, and their job is the law, to look at the law, to apply it to the case and to decide the case and to not be influenced by external forces. And that would be someone like Justice Thomas, who on cases that he's involved in, cases the court's involved in, he deliberately does not read newspaper articles about those cases because he doesn't want to be influenced by public opinion. He believes that he should be influenced only by what the law says. So you get a wide variety of views among the justices on, you know, whether or not they should think about public opinion or not. But there's no question that conservatives believe that of the justices who do care about public opinion, that public opinion always seems to pull them to the left.
I think that at least a couple of the members of the current court, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Scalia, have taken this approach to interpreting the Constitution that says something like, we believe that the Constitution still means what it meant to the guys who wrote it, and that as we are thinking about making our decisions and considering the Constitution, that they're not of that camp that says we need to change the way we think over time, and that if the founders could come here to the present, they would and understand
right.
present conditions, they would, you know, they might have some different sort of attitudes. They have this attitude that says, no, it says what it says. It means what it means, and what it meant then is what it means now.
Well, they believe that, and Thomas and Scalia don't see eye to eye all the time, and one of the main things that I discovered in the research about Justice Thomas and his real role on the court, by the way, was just fascinating. We can talk about that later. But, you know, Thomas and Scalia, when they do agree, when they is looking at the Constitution, and like you said, they believe that, you know, judges need to very narrowly read the Constitution, that they're unelected judges. You know, they shouldn't be filling in the blanks, that, you know, that's for the elected officials to do. And so they look at the Constitution and how it was understood, how the framers understood it and these tenets at the time. The liberal justices, like Justice Breyer and Ginsburg, they have a more evolving view, and they think that they've got to look at the Constitution in context of today and how, you know, it should be applied today, you know, in terms of our modern-day problems and concerns. So that's a very dramatic, and obviously it produces really different results when you see these splits on some of these big social issues between the liberals and the conservatives.
Well, we have a number of other callers here, and we're coming into about our last 15 minutes, so I will get back here to people on the phone. We have a couple. Someone here calling from Muhammad, not very far away, on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I guess I'll just make two quick comments. The first one is Scalia basically lies when he says he's a strict constructionist. They interpret, everybody interprets, they interpret the way they want to interpret, and that, I think, is a total myth. Anyway, my other comment, which is what I really called about, was it's interesting now that we have an African-American and a woman running for president, and they keep talking about back in the days when Kennedy broke the Catholic barrier, that nobody on the Supreme Court, we're talking about the Supreme Court, mentions the incredible overrepresentation of Catholics. And it doesn't seem to enter into the issues of the abortion as though the fact that you have Catholics, and so many of them, what is it, five or six?
There are five Catholics.
Five so far, on the court, makes any difference. And it's just, it shows you how mainstreaming things get. It's not like their Catholicism has any effect on their beliefs, and I don't think it does. I don't think they're anti-abortion because they're Catholics. In fact, I think Scalia said that anybody who can't enforce, for example, the capital punishment because they're it's against their religion, shouldn't be on the court.
But, and, you know, Justice Kennedy is Catholic, and he has voted repeatedly over the years not to overturn Roe versus Wade. So it doesn't always, you're right. But that came up during the confirmation hearing, although very, you know, briefly. And then, you know, a couple people wrote stories about it, that Alito would be the fifth Catholic on the Supreme Court. And then, you know, we have two Jewish members on the Supreme Court. So, you know, the issue of religion did come up, but then it was just very briefly mentioned, and no one read much into it. So that is a sign, I think you're right, of how things have changed. And, you know, the interesting thing when you talk about the next nominees, and when we think about who's running for president, I believe, just like we were talking about with the last caller, that the court could be such a pivotal issue, because think about how different this Supreme Court could look if the next president gets two nominations, and if the next president is, you know, Hillary or Senator Obama, or if the next president is McCain or Giuliani. I mean, and the court, as we all see, I mean, what a dramatic impact that it has in our lives, you know, in a president's most lasting legacy. How can the, you know, Senator Feinstein told John Roberts during his confirmation hearings, you know, you might be up there 40 years, you know, after I'm long gone from this earth. And so the next presidential election, I suspect, we will be talking some about the court.
Let me just pick up on the caller's question about the issue of judicial activism, because this is something on which conservatives sometimes attack judges that they think are liberal, and they use this term activist.
Right.
And some people argue that, you know, there may be liberal activism, but there's also conservative activism. And in fact, if you take a look at the willingness of members of the court to overturn an action of Congress, that in fact justices like Mr. Scalia turn out to be much more, if that's your measure of activism, turn out to be much more activist than some of their more liberal colleagues.
That's right. And people, you know, academics certainly have been writing large articles kind of documenting that trend of how some of the conservative justices are much more willing, you know, to reach out and, like you said, strike down these acts of Congress than some of the other justices we think of as liberal, like Justice Breyer, for example. I think that what we can walk away from that, though, is that, you know, sometimes labels just don't mean anything at all. And activism is one, you know, and basically I think what we can say about judicial activism is that that is just a decision that people just disagree with. You know, if you're a conservative and you're criticizing a liberal ruling and you call it activist, it means you don't agree with it. And the same true for the other side. And I think it's also true for some of these other labels. John Roberts talked a lot about modesty, you know, during his confirmation hearings. He said he was going to, you know, he believed he should have a modest role. Well, what does that really mean, to be modest? And people interpret it to mean two totally different things. The liberal senators, the Democrats, they thought, well, that's good. You know, a modest justice surely would never overturn Roe versus Wade. You know, that is reassuring to us. But the conservatives heard John Roberts say he was modest, and they thought, that's good. They thought the same thing, because, you know, a modest judge surely would never let Roe versus Wade, you know, the one that they see that as the most immodest decision, surely would never let that decision continue to stand. So, you know, sometimes the labels, you know, you just have to get beyond them and see them, that they don't really tell us all that much.
Okay, let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask two questions, if I may. First, have you had occasion to see the public broadcasting series about the history of the court, and how do you feel about its accuracy or impact?
I haven't. You know, I've been out of town for the last 2 weeks, and I've got the tapes of it, and I just haven't had a chance to look at it. Although Jeff Rosen, who is a terrific writer, and I've read his book, you know, he's written a companion book to it, which is just fascinating about how the personalities and dynamics over time, you know, his book is kind of a historical look at the court, how that can affect the decisions. And Jeff and I have done a couple events together. We're going to be talking tomorrow night at the Constitution Center, because, you know, he talks about the history and how those personal dynamics affect the time, and based on that series, too. And then my book, of course, is more the modern-day story, and how I get into that, too. How, for example, how Justice Thomas, when he came on the court, I was saying earlier, his real role on the court. He was very independent from the beginning, never followed Scalia, a very strong conservative, and as a result, he made the court shift to the left, which is completely counterintuitive, but it caused O'Connor to really back away. Anyway, that was kind of a long answer, wasn't it? Sorry.
I was impressed by that series when they dwelt on the Andrew Jackson time.
And, uh-huh. And
that was really a shuddering effect, because it was pretty basic power politics all around.
Mm-hmm.
But the second question I want to bring up is asking your guess for the chance of this court as it is, or perhaps soon, to be a surprising court. I'm always hearing about the Earl Warren effect, mm-hmm. that a conservative president mm-hmm. appoints a conservative governor, and nobody was prepared for the Warren court to do what it did. So do you have a sense of the likelihood of any surprises?
I don't. I would say that's zero, and for two reasons. Number one, yeah, I think that the Bush White House really succeeded in getting two very solid, very disciplined, very conservative justices up there on the Supreme Court. And the interesting, I think, thing when we think about it, particularly with Roberts, is that a lot of people just, and the liberal groups here, you know, very highly persuasive advocates, very well connected, they could not get anyone to listen. And people really just couldn't quite believe that Roberts was really a conservative. So even some of the Democratic senators, you know, they would hear Roberts testify or they'd meet him in their office, and, you know, they just couldn't grasp that he was really a solid judicial conservative, and that was a source of enormous frustration to the People for the American Way and the Alliance for Justice and some of those liberal groups who believe that he very much was a solid judicial conservative. And I think the White House is very convinced of that. And, you know, based on my reading of his opinions, Roberts sees the court as really that it should be kind of removing itself from some of these social issues and social debates and turning some of that over to the legislatures. He thinks the court's gotten too involved in some of those societal disputes. That's a very conservative outlook. And I do think that the chances of surprise that Roberts or Alito might end up being more liberal than anyone thinks are very slim. Now, that said, that doesn't mean the court, you know, the surprises can come in other ways. As I was just mentioning, when Justice Thomas joined the court, remember, he was replacing that, you know, great liberal icon, Thurgood Marshall. Everyone thought the court was going to go to the right that year. And Thomas certainly was very conservative. He didn't change. He wasn't surprising. But you know what happened? O'Connor did. She moved over to the left. So sometimes the dynamics can affect the court in surprising ways.
The question, I think, is really a fascinating one about how it is that, you know, I would think that an administration, if you're working up a list of people that you would nominate to the Supreme Court, you would spend an extraordinary amount of time and energy trying to determine who that person was, what they believed, and what they would do if they became a member of the court. How is it that a conservative, a Republican administration who was interested in putting a conservative on the court, given the fact that they should do all that kind of work, would end up with somebody who they thought was conservative and then quickly started to move to the left, and it turned out that they weren't nearly as conservative as they thought?
Well, I guess David Souter is the best example of that, wouldn't you think? Yeah. So, and Souter, the story of David Souter is a fascinating one, and I kind of get into it in the book because for a while, Souter was a combination of a couple of things. I mean, there was a huge front runner inside the White House. Everyone just assumed it was going to be this one guy, and so people weren't really looking at Souter that closely, and they didn't vet him that well. And then when a group of lawyers in the Justice Department said, no, we can't have the front runner, he's not conservative enough, that created this vacuum that allowed Souter to step into it. But you know who the front runner was? It was Ken Starr. And so imagine what our court would look like today. But a group of conservative lawyers in the Justice Department at the time blocked Starr again because they thought he wasn't conservative enough. And then President H.W. Bush, you know, looking for someone else, the front runner has fallen out. His chief of staff, Sununu, and Senator Redmond were telling him that David Souter would be great. He didn't have a paper trail, and that was right after Bork, so that was very important. No one knew David Souter. People said he was conservative, but they didn't know, and Souter himself didn't know. He had only been a federal judge for weeks. He'd never ruled on these kind of federal constitutional issues. So the fact that he had no paper trail, no one had any idea about Souter, including, I think, Souter himself. But the story of Souter and how he became a justice instead of Ken Starr, it's almost hard to imagine. And then when you think about our Supreme Court today and all those 5-4 decisions and what it would look like if it'd been Justice Starr instead of Justice Souter, and it's quite amazing how one decision can affect history. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure people wonder what the court would be like if we had Justice Bork.
Right.
And there was a case,
Justice Kennedy.
Was a case where a guy who certainly would have met the qualifications of conservatives, and here the administration had somebody that they really wanted, and yet that was not successful.
Right. And, you know, remember when after Bork went down and then the replacement went down and then they ended up with Kennedy, who a lot of people never thought was that conservative inside the administration at the time in the Reagan administration. And then, of course, that also led to President H.W. Bush looking for this kind of bland, easily confirmable nominee, and that's partly how he ended up with David Souter. This White House did not do that. You know, Sam Alito was on the bench 15 years. He had a an extensive paper trail. The groups really thought they had the smoking gun on him. They found a memo where he said he thought Roe should be overturned. You know, they believed they had the goods. They thought they could block him. And at the end of the day, they just couldn't do it.
Just, we're coming down to we're almost out of time. Just something really quick. There has been a lot written lately about the declining workload of the court and why that is and whether it really matters one way or another. Is there a good answer to that question? Why is it the court is hearing so many fewer cases than in past years?
Some people have speculated that, you know, the lower courts are just agreeing on things more. And one reason might be technology. You know, back in the old days, all these cases weren't readily available online. The briefs weren't readily available online. The law clerks at the Supreme Court who are advising their justices on cases that they might want to take up, you know, they can go back now and just type in the computer and see where there are conflicts and where there aren't. So technology actually could be fueling some of that. It may just be making more consistency because, you know, the court, the Supreme Court, doesn't normally get involved unless the lower courts are divided.
And one other thing, again, just noting that it's interesting that the justices traditionally don't talk a lot about themselves, don't give all that many interviews, don't make personal appearances. Lately, a number of them seem to have been doing that. I'm interested in that little bit greater bit of openness and perhaps the question of, do you think, say, in our lifetime, we might one day turn on C-SPAN and see the Supreme Court?
Well, it's been really interesting to see, and I've been fortunate to talk with Roberts and Justice Stevens for Nightline, and I interviewed Scalia and Breyer at a debate recently. It's been just terrific. And, you know, they all have seemed to come across to me explaining their views. And so I think it's been very worthwhile. But I think that that's about all we're going to get. You know, Justice Souter famously said many years ago that cameras will go in the courtroom when his dead body's going out. And our new Chief Justice the other day said, you know, he'd hate to do anything that would hasten Justice Souter's demise. So I don't think we're going to be seeing cameras in the courtroom, probably not in my lifetime. But I do think what's going to happen is, you know, they've started releasing the audio, and that's a pretty good compromise. I mean, we can't see them talking, you know, we just got to picture it, but we can hear them. We can hear their voices, hear their tone, and I think that that's worked very well. So who knows? I mean, maybe that's kind of, you know, the first crack, but I think we'll have that audio for a while. Camera's still pretty far off.
Well, if people are interested in reading about the Supreme Court and how things work and also how the court has changed and attempts to change the court, going back to, roughly speaking, the presidency of Richard Nixon, you can take a look at the book Supreme Conflict, the Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court. It's published by the Penguin Press by our guest, Jan Crawford Greenberg. She's correspondent for ABC News. Ms. Greenberg, thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for having me, David. It was a pleasure being with you.